this panel. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another fabulous episode of Peach and the Colonel. How are you, Peach?
I'm good. How are you, Chris?
Pretty good.
That's good.
I'm not Chris, though. I'm the Colonel.
Oh, that's right. You're the Colonel. I always do that. Sorry, Colonel.
That's all right. But if you say Colonel, it's better to say the Colonel.
Oh, really? Does it need the to be more official?
No.
Does the come with a capital T?
Yeah.
It's all capitalized.
At all, I see. At all times.
Sorry, I didn't realize that we were going by titles.
Yeah. No, that's all right. We'll forge forward nevertheless.
Indeed, yes.
Look, we're delighted to announce today that we have a special guest in the studio with us. I'd like you to introduce yourself and maybe tell us a bit about yourself.
Sure. It's Michael War, although you can call me the Michael if you like.
With a capital T.
With a capital
Michael.
T. I work as a teacher. I work as a musician. I work as a dad and a partner and a grandfather. And I suppose that's the breadth of my life.
That's enough to fill up anyone's calendar, I would have thought.
Well and truly.
Is your favourite bit the granddad bit?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yep.
How does being a grandparent compare to being a parent?
Mm.
Oh, wow, that's a really good question. There's something really beautiful, first of all, about the relationship that I'm able to have with my son now that is puts us both on this equal sort of footing.
Yeah.
Like we actually... He gets my love for him now because he has this love for his daughter.
Yeah.
So it's this really lovely thing that I have with him. And he's able to confide in me in ways that, you know, when you sort of lose your son when they're 13 or 14 and suddenly you become the most uncool person in the universe.
The enemy.
The
yeah.
enemy,
yeah.
That guy,
mm.
That he's able to then sort of realise where a lot of those choices were coming from.
I think it's
really beautiful.
In the early days, I think your stocks are artificially boosted by the fact that, you know, you're the only grown man who's a best friend as a child, you know, dad's Superman and everything.
Mm.
So there's got to be a bit of a fall from grace, but it generally the pendulum swings a great deal the other way, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. Way further than you think, I think.
So that's beautiful, but it's also then... You have this little person in your world and get to share in all of those joys of watching her go through her little milestones. And, I mean, there's the clichés about you love them and you give them back.
Mm.
But it's...
Is it a cliché for a reason? Is it true?
A little bit, yeah. But you sort of... I don't know. I feel like I'm the wingman for my son now, which is pretty cool.
That's nice. Yeah. That's a nice way of describing it.
What would you let your granddaughter do that you would have never have let your son do? Have you become a bit more relaxed or less anxious as a grandparent?
I think it's what's really lovely is that because she is not a sedate baby. Like she's just turned one. And she will let you know if she's not happy. And I think that there's this thing about, and I'm not sure whether it's that I'm actually incredibly proud that I've got this outspoken young woman sort of growing up. And it's like, you let them know. If you don't like them, you let them know. And I think that I'm really happy about that. Perhaps because I don't have to bear the brunt of the what she finds unpleasant a lot of the time.
That's it.
But, probably that. Just voicing her displeasure with the universe. Okay, yep, you let him know.
Good on you.
Good on you.
Yeah.
Anyone but me, you let him know.
Yeah, exactly.
Now tell me, you're also a musician, and we'll get to that because you've released some new music that we'd like to point people in the direction of. What sort of role does being a parent and a grandparent play in terms of your art? Do you draw inspiration from that?
Well, this whole record is about my family. Like every song in some way is about my family and about reflecting on where I've been and where I'm going, I suppose through the lens of, you know, my childhood, my hometown, my relationship with my parents, my relationship with my son. Mm. So, I mean, there's that sort of the material that I'm drawing from all comes from there. Sure. But it's also a way of, like, because relationships are tricky, and to work through those feelings, like, that's how I express myself. I'm not always in control of songwriting. Like, I've spoken to some songwriters who go, yeah, I like to sit down and plan a time where I write, it's a phrase, it's a thought, it's a feeling, and it will express itself as music, and it's the way that I work through the emotional experience of those relationships, I suppose. Well, sure. All of the songs on this record have been, yeah.
Where does songwriting or, for you, Peach, things like playwriting, where does the artistic part come? Like, is that between 3 and 4 a.m.? Is it,
We were sort of just talking about this, weren't we, Michael? Like, it's that interesting thing of just giving yourself permission to do it, I think, firstly, and not feeling worried about where it's going or how you're getting paid or anything like that. And I think, in the end, it's about storytelling, and there's a sort of power in that. And if you let yourself tell the story, well, if you don't let yourself tell the story, then it's going to come out in some other weird way. Like, that's sort of what I've learned. That's part of it. You've got to work through that stuff at some point. Exactly. I don't know. But you said, Michael, like, it just comes out in funny ways, and you have to sort of just go with that. And whether or not that ends up on stage or not is sort of not the point.
No.
No. And as long as you accept that it's process, and that it, like we were talking last time about, Ira Glass and the gap, between what you want to achieve artistically and what you actually produce, which you go, oh, that's not actually, these things don't necessarily marry, what I want to do and what I am doing. But once you accept that reality, I think then you can overcome some level of judgment and just do it. Mm. Mind you, this is a recent revelation for me, I have to admit.
Yeah.
I
love that phrase that you just used about giving yourself permission.
Yeah.
Because I think it is really, there's something that we, and it is something especially, I think, for teachers, because our job is about facilitating kids expressing
always
themselves.
About others, yeah.
Yeah, that to actually say, it's okay for me to do this. And because I played for a long time and then I stopped for 10 years more.
Mm.
And I started again because my family was in crisis. My son was going through a really hard time. Because of that, my partner was going through a really hard time. And it was like hard stuff at work and hard stuff at home.
Yeah.
And it was like there was no me in between those two extremes.
It's so funny, isn't it? Going, it's kind of where you need it the most. In many ways, having that artistic outlet is probably that's when you need it.
And it's bugger it because, like, too, when you're in your 20s, I think you're fighting to be famous, or you're fighting to be rich, or you're fighting to be all these things that artists are presented to us as being. And then at some point, if you allow yourself, if you give yourself permission to do that, it's just about the pure joy of that expression and that, connection with your art.
Yeah. I find that in terms of starting, I'm happy to give myself time. I built this studio so I can just come in here and doodle and, make some sounds. It's the finishing part. Like, at some point it crosses over from being a nice artistic process to I have to put a deadline on myself that this song's going to be done so that I can perform it live or record it or, it has to move past that stage at some point. Mm.
Wasn't that Da Vinci that said that art is never completed but merely abandoned?
Yeah. It's beautiful and it's true. It's really so true. Mm. My bottom drawer is proof of that. I can't tell you how many half-written plays are in there.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I'm never happy. And one rule I wish I would have learnt when I was younger is that, I'm a jack of all trades, and I love writing a song and then recording and then producing it and then doing a choral arrangement of it, and I love it all. But as a result, you get caught up in forever.
Yeah.
Whereas if you just write a song and you turn up to a studio, you submit to someone else as a producer and say, complete this for me, then that's out of your hands. I mean, they might still feel that it's an incomplete production from their point of view, but the fact that you let it go and then they let it go to the mixer and then the mixer lets it go to the mastering studio and everyone just has to get over themselves at some point. Whereas I never did. Yeah, I just never got over myself.
Yeah. Well, it has been interesting for you working with the producer you're working with at the moment, hasn't it?
And,
you know, I think it's that is part of it, though, accepting that other people are going to contribute to what you're doing. That's quite difficult, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe with playwriting it's a bit different because you just know that you can't perform all the roles.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to give it to actors.
But you could say the same thing about writer-directors.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
There's something that another director can take what you've done, bring all that stuff out, but then bring totally extras, whereas you're sort of locked into that original sort of vision.
Hmm.
I find that interesting.
Yeah.
Reminds me of I went to an APRA talk once at, I think it was BMW Edge or somewhere, where they were talking about the role between a musician and a producer. And the first relationship they were looking at were some of the producers who produce all the sort of Australian Idol material.
Mm.
They were talking about their process and they say, oh, we watch Idol and we try and pick who's the winner and then we work out their vocal range and what their sweet notes are and we just write around that. We write a hit that they can sing for that first album when they win and we write songs for everyone just in case they win and it's so calculated and we look at what's trending at the moment. We look at what keys people are...
Mm.
Down to everything was this rank kind of icky science.
Recipe, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And then you had, I can't remember his name, but the guy who was producing Lior at the time when he did that Autumn Flow album, which was just magnificent. And it was so different. They were like, oh, no, we work on our relationship. We work on how we communicate. And then we work on, you know, we think about the songs and we give ourselves time to just think what they could be and we imagine.
Mm.
Just thought, oh, I wish all music was like the latter, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And we were saying that too, that it's like once you take a step back from the industry and it's not about the making of money, I think it is, you can get back to the true, like the core of what you're doing and why you're doing it.
Mm.
Why
are you doing it, Michael?
Again, that's a really good question that made me sort of look up at the ceiling and given that the podcast is not a visual medium, that's probably didn't communicate very well.
You're doing it again.
I'm doing it again.
There's nothing up there. Yeah. There's no clues.
There's lots of parts of it. The first one, as I said, I think it's about just the expression of those feelings. I do lots of songwriting on bicycles. Mm. So I sort of, it's a bit like, sometimes it feels a bit like I've got a broken radio in my head that's always playing an annoyingly hooky song.
Yeah.
And that's usually the one that I'm writing at the time. And sometimes it will just come into my, usually it will come into my head while I'm on a bike and I'm thinking about, you know, not getting hit by a truck and dying. Mm. And that's how songwriting often happens, but it will connect in with a word, a phrase, an idea, a feeling that's come from my past.
You have an interesting story about the way, I remember you telling me about the way Terrorists and Planes, that song came about, which I think is quite an interesting way of describing your process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that song started as being I was watching kids play around school, and it was like they were playing all of these violent games, and that was in the back of my head. But when I was at Shane's house recording the record, and I woke up one morning. And the kids outside, instead of playing Cops and Robbers or Batman and Robin, they were playing Terrorists and Planes. And it was this,
I know.
Sign of the times.
And exactly. So that first verse of that song was you know, it was almost fully formed. It was the story of, you know, the kids mucking around in the backyard.
Mm.
And then I got up and on the front page of the newspaper was the Jihad Joey stuff. So it was around the time when... You know, we had this 18-year-old kid in Endeavour Hills with a knife, got got killed by these cops.
Yeah.
And for me, that watching, listening to those kids in the backyard reminded me of, and that the image of that kid was sort of connected. And another memory for me was about my this boy who used to skate near my son, with my son, and he was killed in a again in a shootout with police. He had a kitchen knife from Kmart, and he got killed by police.
Northcote. I think I was living in Northcote at the time.
That's right. Remember. Yeah. So that's for me. That was that fear, the anxiety about being a parent in this time, and you know, kids who are growing up playing terrorists and planes, and what they're exposed to, how they're impacted by that. So the whole story of that song was there, and for me it was like this incessant, like the call of those kids playing terrorists and planes was that was the poetry, that was the music that was in that song.
Yeah,
but they all have different lives, as I know, like, you know, characters in plays, they all have different lives, they all speak to you.
But I just think it's interesting the way you, like, that had sort of three links, you know, it's got that sort of strand of memory, strand of present day, strand of sort of current affairs all linked in. And I think that's where a lot of that storytelling in your music, it can be so powerful, especially for people, you know, living rurally, because you're often telling those stories from a rural childhood, you know, growing up in Gippsland.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, there's so many... From what you've described, there's just so many people in Gippsland who find that very, you know, really satisfying to hear their own kind of background described back to them in song, you know, and that's been part of the, you know, that's memory and kind of the reality of place tying together and making for powerful songwriting, which I think is kind of an interesting theme in what you do. Yeah. Mm.
I mean, the Gippsland stuff is very interesting because I sort of had shied away from telling it, singing it for a very long time. And I think because as you sort of described, that cynical approach to songwriting, we're force-fed that stuff through videos and through the radio all the time. And you sort of go, there's no poetry in Hayfield. There's no poetry in the McAllister River. There's no poetry in my dad being covered in cow shit. There's no poetry in that stuff, but really that's the texture of my life. The songs that I were hearing were so banal and so generic, and I thought that that's what music had to be. And if I was going to be successful in music, I had to emulate this thing that was so shallow that it had to have no diving signs around it.
Yeah.
And that when I gave myself permission to start telling those stories, what I found was not only was it connecting with people in that community who suddenly heard music in, well, this is what they've said to me, were hearing music in their town, but when I was playing it in Tamworth or when I was playing it in Sydney, that people there could identify their own stories in it because it was so specific that it was, that they could apply their own specific stories to it too.
Sure. Yeah. Mm. And it really brings up the, we don't think about it much these days, but the role of an artist or the role of a bard in a town. Mm. You know, there was a day when for every village it was somebody's job to collect the stories
and reflect them back.
Like it's a really important part of society, and when you've got these artists who, it's not their job to collect stories and to share, it's their job to make money. It's their job to look good.
Different purpose.
It's their job to wear the right stuff at all times, make the right faces. It's not really aiding our culture. In fact, in many ways, it's sort of deconstructing it to.
But as you said, Michael, it becomes very generic. You know, they could be a singer-songwriter from England or from the US, and it's all the same.
Yeah.
You know, what's lovely about that use of imagery that is specific to a place and to a time is that there's a deep nostalgia in it that works for so many people to connect with it on whatever level they choose to connect with it. But, you know, you think about so many of the lyrics I hear on commercial radio and they, you know, I mean, the key themes are love and heartbreak. And that's about it.
Yeah.
Like, there's not, oh, there's the occasional, like, let's sing about my unborn child or my, you know, sort of sad song. Or like that, who's the guy at the moment who's singing that? I took a plane to Ibiza to tell Avicii I was cool. And like I just came back with a hangover, and you don't want to be like me, stuck up on stage and all I know is sad songs. And I just think that is like that is the call of the pop star, like this sort of empty vessel singing sad songs that actually they haven't written or that don't really mean anything to them.
But they probably don't have time. You know, someone comes to Australia to tour. They don't see Australia.
No,
they
exactly.
They see Sydney for a night, then they sleep, and then they see Melbourne for a night, and they sleep.
And they just see a stadium, really, don't they? They don't really,
That's all they can see because there's all these screaming teenage girls who don't want to let them live. It's like we stop anyone being normal these days.
We set them up on that pedestal and then,
But from what you said, like I reckon the people who wrote Sweet Home Alabama or Sweet Home Chicago or New York, New York, to them is like a folk tune.
Yeah.
It was absolutely. Just, they probably have doubts and thinking it was just a, you know. Too
Cause
local?
Because that was when the door opened for me, was actually seeing an American singer. I took my parents to see Dolly Parton play. Because when I was growing up, there was a Dolly Parton cassette that would have Dolly Parton's greatest hits. And, like, we would just play it over and over again. It was like this really sad form of child abuse that we were But I loved the story songs, but they were all songs about where Dolly came from. And my mum got really sick and I spent about a month's wages in buying tickets for them to go and see her because I wanted them to have this joyous moment with Dolly. And it was like we went to Rod Laver Arena and it was like half the audience were people like my parents from country communities and the other half was every drag queen in Melbourne. All coming together.
What a great audience.
And a heap of surgeons looking for work.
Absolutely. And this is the thing. Dolly looked like younger than she did on that cassette from 1978 or whatever it was. And we're listening to this. And they had this like massive, they'd built like a formica log cabin on Rod Laver Arena stage. And Dolly's sitting there and she's telling this story about her Tennessee mountain home. It's one of her famous songs, In My Tennessee Mountain Home. And Dad turns to Mum and says, yeah, but they don't write songs about girls from Hayfield. And I went, that's the song. That's the song. And so I wrote the song Hayfield Girl about how every song that I grew up with was about an American woman. And where was the song about the girl from Hayfield? Because it wasn't being told. And, it has been. That's like, you know, that's a lie. There are great Australian folk singers and country singers, but I wasn't hearing it enough. I certainly didn't grow up with it. I didn't turn on commercial radio and hear it. And that's really bloody sad. Where are our folk stories, as you say? Like, you know, we've got to start telling them. And they're not commercially successful. Who bloody cares? Because it's connecting with people. It's telling people stories. And isn't that what music should be doing? Isn't that what art should be doing? Reflecting our lives. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it brings back into question what society should give back to artists. And you know, we get this idea these days. It's like, oh well, you're a singer. Everyone loves to sing. Why would you have to be paid for that? You know, living somewhere like Melbourne, there's enough kids who'll sing for free. So there's, you know, so why would you pay somebody to come and sing? But I think, I don't know, it is a really valuable part. There's places in Europe where people, you know, you can live tax exempt as an artist and you can, you know, there's lots of different ways around the world that artists get get treated well.
But that connection with community and the power of particularly music to generate community is interesting, and it's very much connected to what you're doing at the moment with your work. And we talked about it really briefly last time as well, but I think it's probably one of those things that maybe is undervalued because it's difficult to measure. Do you know what I mean? We can measure record sales. Yeah. We can and it's just one of those things that Zerafina sort of said this last time, you know, how do you actually understand that this is about souls connecting. Like, on a really, like, I know that sounds really quite ridiculous, but it's sort of true. That's the truth of art. You know, when it works, when your actor-audience relationship is strong enough, that is exactly what you're doing. And it's that is an impossible, it's the X factor of theatre, of music, of all of it. You know, when you're live and you're making a connection, it's the same when you read a book and you connect with what the writer's saying.
But isn't that because the recorded sound is an abstraction of that. It takes it into a different place. And a performance is a dialogue, not a monologue.
Mm.
And so when you have, like, you look at the audience and you go, shit, I better play a funny song next because they're not coping with all of this stuff, or the capacity for someone to actually show, and they show through their applause whether they're really into what you're doing or not, whether you've caught the wave. But it's the conversation afterwards as well, where if you say, like, there's lots of times where I've been able to share a personal story and then for somebody else to say, this is my experience of cancer or this is my experience of bullying, and the part of your festival experience then as an artist becomes about communion with your audience.
Mm.
That's really bloody priceless. And I don't know, too, that whole megastar thing, which is really, it's an invention of the last 50, 60 years. It's not that old as a construct, but it is the crap sort of image that we all aspire to as artists, that we think to be sustainable, we've got to be that guy. But the death of that because of you know, the internet and the capacity for everyone to share music and those middlemen dying in terms of the income that they were deriving from, you know, vampirically sucking the life out of artists means that, like, people are going to click. They've got the power of the click, and they'll click into the thing that they're connected to that is connecting to them. And I think that's really so beautiful that people do have a lot more control. The audience has more control.
It's the ultimate democratization of art.
And so some people decry, oh, well, you know, I can't earn a living from this anymore. It's like,
you've got to find other ways, don't you?
Art is about life. That's what it is. It's a way of living. It's not how you earn your livelihood necessarily. It's great. I think it's beautiful that some people do earn their living from just making art. But if you live your art in an artistically authentic way, that's so much more powerful.
It's very rewarding in itself to have people sort of enjoy it. Like, when you put yourself out 100%, and somebody appreciates it, it's validation. It's, you know.
On Saturday night, I met this woman at the CD launch, and she said to me, she'd gone camping in Flinders, so she's gone to South Australia, and she met this guy camping. So they're in the middle of nowhere. She meets this one guy, and they start talking about music, and she mentions me, that she's really found this connection with this song. This guy's burst into tears, and he's then revealed that his wife has just died, and at her funeral he asked for Hayfield Girl to be played.
Wow.
So my song got to be a part of the celebration of this person's life.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
That's bloody magic. And that little connection then that this woman had with my music, and that he had with that, then connected these two strangers in the middle of another state. Who gets to do that?
That's brilliant.
Bloody artist. That's gorgeous.
Yeah.
My brother wrote a song once, or we wrote a song together called Cheeky Girl.
Yeah.
And what was amazing to me was how many women came up to him after shows with this kind of winky nod, like, I know that song was written about me.
Yeah, right.
So many people thought it was. And it was, I mean, that's the brilliant thing about music. Mm. The less answers you give in a song, the more open for interpretation it can be, and the more it means to everybody. Mm.
And isn't it amazing, as an audience, our capacity to read ourselves into everything? Yeah. You know, I always think that's so funny when you sort of sit down even to watch, like, your reality TV, And there's something in it that you sort of voyeuristically love because it's not you. But if it was you, what would you do? You know, that sort of like incredible kind of tension that's generated by projecting yourself into it.
I had this interesting thing recently where this woman had seen the video for Hayfield Girl, and there's a shot in it where someone is walking a dog, and it's a shot of a dog and a picture of this woman. And this woman sent me this really quite angry message about that she thought I was making a comparison between women from this town and this dog. And the truth of the matter was that, like, the whole concept of
the video... You
don't
have to reveal whether you were or...
No. Yeah. But the concept of the video was that we wanted to do a portrait of women in this country town in their environment. So it's the environmental portraits of these women. And they're bloody beautiful. It's really... I'm so proud of that clip because it's this whole range of different people in places where we found them. The woman in the fish and chip shop and the woman that was in a house showing her... knitting and craft wear that she loves, the woman who was standing in front of the church, the woman who was walking her dog. And it was just all of those women that we caught. But this person projected onto that this, like, hatred, you know, that it must be this painful thing that you're trying to do. I've been really lucky because I think lots of people projected positive stuff about themselves onto that.
That's like the risk you take too, though, isn't it? That's right. That's that thing. You can't tell what somebody's going to bring to it or how they're going to interpret it. That's right. Yeah.
And that's the end. And at the end, but because we have that dialogue going with audience in perhaps a much more immediate way than...
Because of the internet. Yeah.
That you, if you don't like something, you can let me know and I can read it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Instantly.
Instantly.
Yeah.
But it's difficult then to separate yourself from the piece of art that you've created.
Well, as you said, it was so you weren't sure how to express that you were being sincere.
Yeah.
That, you know, and you soon realised that it wouldn't have mattered what you'd said, that was her agenda and that, you know. But I think that's interesting too, particularly, I mean, we've talked about this too, Chris, like the troll thing, you know. You are very exposed. As soon as you put yourself in that public eye, you become very exposed to people bringing their baggage to you or choosing to find something negative in what you said.
The last country festival we did was up in Yakandanda.
Yeah, that one? Yeah, great. I know festival. It really well, yeah.
So we did a cover of Marry a Woman Uglier Than You, which is an old traditional.
Yeah.
It's probably a bit dated. Like, it's... You know, it's singing about how if you want to be super happy in life, you shouldn't marry a pretty woman because she wouldn't be as good to you as someone who felt they, you know, had to work hard for it.
Or playing to their A game.
It's a pretty outdated concept, but likewise, it's not our song. It's obviously not our message, and it's pretty twee the way we do it. Anyway, we got some
It's super twee.
Yeah.
Yeah, like you guys do deliberately. It's a parody.
It's very silly. It's
meant to be funny.
It's very silly. And we got some pretty serious complaints about that. But as opposed to somebody coming to us and saying, look, I really didn't like that song, it was publicly done on our Facebook page.
Yeah.
And it was like, you've just lost a fan. I can't believe how you could normalise the mistreatment of, you know, anything other than society's definition of beauty. Yeah.
Well, you've got Siri talking again. This happens all the time. She likes talking
Siri,
to you.
Shut up, Siri. Go away. Okay, she said okay. That's good. Sorry about that.
No worries.
We just got to make sure.
Siri's always welcome.
She often chimes in. Yeah, randomly. I don't know what's going on with the Colonel's phone. But
we just can't say anything that rhymes with Hey Siri.
Right, okay.
I don't know what else would.
Perhaps we should make a little song up called Hey Siri. That's quite a good idea.
Yeah.
But no, back to my point. Mm. When people are publicly attacking your brand in a public sphere, You can't control what goes on.
No.
And you could sit and argue with them, but that just makes things worse.
It doesn't help.
So your only option is, I mean, we've just never sung the song again.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, right.
And we're not the sort of guys who are super concerned about what other people think either. We quite like, we try and make it our mission.
You're often deliberately politically correct in your singing. With certain songs.
Politically incorrect.
Yeah, sorry, did I say politically correct? Oh, sorry, incorrect.
Yeah, we pride ourselves that at least one you know, super conservative religious person should walk out of every one of our shows. And that's kind of, it actually makes other people feel better about themselves. They're like, old Janice, oh, she's such a stick in the mud. And it makes everyone else, you know, get into it a bit more.
Yeah, right.
No, it's just very different. It's very different that other people have the right to attack you publicly, whereas before they didn't.
Mm.
And
if you attack back, you'll be viewed more harshly than the initial attacker because you're the public persona.
No, there's just no win.
No, exactly.
There's just no win out of it.
Yeah. Mm.
But there is something too about men speaking about anything about gender. I think we are in a place where gender has become something that's very difficult to discuss. So it is. Mm. There's lots of toes to be stood on.
Well, there's this whole thing about
lots of places too where, for very good reason, men should just shut the hell up.
Yeah.
And listen, because we've been doing a lot of talking for a very bloody long time.
Yeah.
And I think the capacity for someone to actually say, in terms of how women are represented, that's actually just not good enough, I actually think is a pretty good thing. Like, as much as, like, I, you know, from artist to artist, I'd say, I hear your pain, I feel your pain. But there's another part of it which is like, yeah, good, I probably need to just shut up and listen to that a little bit too, which was part of my response to that, the woman with the dog. It's like, I've stood in here in a quite insensitive, clobbing around sort of way, and I don't really actually understand other people's sensitivities around this. So,
I've got mixed feelings about this whole thing because, for me, I had a friend who went through a messy breakup recently, and he was very angry, and he kept saying, you know, fucking hate her, you know, that's all right, isn't it? I'm like, well, it's okay, but you've just got to realise at the end of the whole process that that hate has to go away before the thing's over.
Mm.
A lot of this stuff about trigger words and sexism and stuff at the moment, you can't even say, you can't, what am I trying to say? Things like in the States, there's two words in America that you just can't use, and I'm only going to use them so we know what we're talking about. Nigger. Can't use it at all. It's the most disgraceful word.
They can self-reference that way.
They can, yes. But as a white person, saying that is just not on under any context. Now, to me, there's been a disgraceful, and we share it in our country, there's been a disgraceful amount of racism that goes on. The end goal has to be that that word has no power. The end goal has to be that.
Yeah, but this is tricky. This is funny. I don't know about white people owning it, making it powerless. It's a little it's a little bit like the C word. I don't know if we can say that. We haven't even discussed that. Yeah, can't. It's a little bit, but it's a little bit like that. That's incredibly inflammatory for a lot of people. And but then on the flip side of that, a lot of women have said, no, we're going to say that to own that. To take some of the implied aggression and implied anti-female genitalia notion away from that word. But I'm in two minds as to whether or not that actually is so. And I, I use it, but I sometimes catch myself using it and I think, oh, it's still got bite, that word.
Yeah.
As much as I use it and I try to, it's still got something in it that for me is not that it's a word that it has bite for me more because it is a reference to. I still think it's a little bit like when I call someone a cock. I still have the same. Like, I think it's they're very aggressive sounding words because they use that C. Punchy, you know.
Doc doesn't offend you though.
No.
Flock.
But it's because it's referencing genitals. I think it's because it's referencing somebody's very sex that it becomes sort of highly charged. But then as we were talking to Spencer the other day and that, you know, how are your genitals actually relevant to how you identify? Well, yeah. But look, you know, that's another debate.
But something like, you know, the words get hijacked. The word faggot was used, and I only bring that up because the word fag appears in your song Paul.
Yeah.
And just because of today's kind of thing, it was a trigger word for me. But like faggot meant a pest. Back in the day, it was a bunch of sticks that was tied together, and that became to mean it was difficult to deal with. And then, like, my grandma's from Gippsland, she's from Maui, and, you know, if someone's a pest, oh, silly little faggot. Whether they're a male, a female, a dog, it doesn't matter. Now, that word has been hijacked to mean something else, and now it's not allowed to be used in any context. Now, I understand that the context in which people are taking offence to is fair enough. But I don't see a way that moving forward, 10,000 years into our history, how many words are we not going to be able to say? How many sounds with our lips are we not going to be able to make because it hurts somebody's feelings? I mean,
but maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's about reinventing language so it reflects the values of the society that is speaking that language. We've only got
that many sounds. Oh, go on.
I mean, William Shakespeare made up a lot of words. We can make them up. We can make them up, and we can say they mean anything.
I think the thing too, though, it is about context, and it is also about and intent. And unfortunately, you and I, and again, podcasts are not visual medium, so I'm pointing to the Colonel at this point. You and I, the Colonel, or the for short. We actually don't understand and can never understand the impact of, say, the word that Peachy was talking about before being used on us in a derogatory manner. We never know the power of that. We can never know what it's like to walk down a street by ourselves as a woman and feel the fear of what that experience is like. We can never know what it's like to be sexually harassed. We can never experience that.
Sure.
And the language that sits around that, which we have access to because we can formulate those words, is the language of that that's been used to hurt somebody else. And personally, I don't want to have anything to do with that language. I mean, it's interesting that, well, you know, that's not to say that I haven't used those words.
Yeah, and that you're not singing it. Or no. That you're not, yeah, well, it's funny, but isn't it?
I mean, the thing about Paul was that word
is reflective of someone being hurt. That's what you're trying to get to. Yeah,
and it was about taking those words back that had been thrown to Paul and had been thrown at me while I was sitting on that bus next to him and turn it into our anthem, into our song.
And that's exactly what we're saying about these words coming back and being owned by
the oppressed group. I can use the word fag because that word was used against me. But I don't know that I could use the word and, you know, insert word here that's been used to hurt women.
Yeah.
I don't think it's ever been used to hurt women, that word. Like, you don't call a woman.
Really? Oh, yes, you do.
The C word, generally.
As
a guy, you wouldn't. Like, you'd say, I mean, I hear this conversation a lot in America because they say, oh, you should hear Australians. They use it as a good thing. It's like, oh, you funny cunt. Oh, you silly cunt. And it's true, like, that's the way I use that word more than any. There's never anything.
But I think that's the problem is that maybe, I just think that maybe that's because, and again, it comes back to context, but that's because of the way you've contextualized and used that word. Whereas that word does have an aggressive original context behind it that was directed as an anti-women word. And so even though it's been reframed and made to be owned and made mainstream, it doesn't mean that it's not still being used. I mean, it's that thing, you know, like, it's like the word nigger or something like that where, you know, African-Americans are owning it. And perhaps some white people use it in that same way, you know, or you're a funny nigger. I don't know, maybe not.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound but you know, do you know what I mean? But it's the same problem. It's still got all that history behind it.
Yeah.
It's got baggage. It's language with baggage, language with emotional baggage. Now, as you say, Colonel, we can continue on and potentially get ourselves into all sorts of knots about what's okay and what's not okay and lose a lot of language. But maybe that's and maybe that's actually a loss of history or a loss of like recognition of that oppression, which I think is I think that's not good. But I think what is good is that if we can move above and beyond that to even as like Spencer was saying to, you know, not needing gender specific pronouns and things, you know, to be able to refer to they and them and it not be about he and she so much or, you know, not be defined by gender anymore. Maybe that's interesting too. Like maybe we do just need to look at, I understand that there's probably political correctness can swing too far one way, but I think it's also very much, as you were saying, Michael, and as you were sort of, it's about that, like your own experience, what you come to with it, because you know, like what you, because I remember my father screaming that really violently at my mother, and that was really distressing as a young person. That was very distressing, and so for me, that's what that comes with. That comes with all that hate behind it, as you were talking about your friend within the messy breakup. It comes with this huge amount of distress and anger, and definitely being directed at her and her femaleness and her status as a mother of his child and all of that, you know. Look,
don't get me wrong. I'm all about the love, and I never mean to offend anyone. I guess that's when you say that I haven't had that stuff done against me. That's true. But what's also true is I've never said those words to people with the intent to harm.
But
which is why they're powerless for you. Do you know what I mean? They don't have power for you because they're not within that context. And I agree that words shouldn't have power, but the reality is they do language is very much about oppression and
absolutely. And you were saying like in 100 years, but I reckon in 100 years too, those words will change because people who are not, you know, you and me can change them. They will have the power to change them. But unfortunately, I'm part of a generation, for example, that's used words to hurt the Aboriginal people of in our country. And those words have so much power. I could never say them without connecting to my cultural heritage, which is about harm and massacre. I can't do that. The best that I could do is shut up and listen when someone is trying to tell me about what that experience is like to be hurt by those words.
I think what's so good about the current state of things is that people are starting to talk about that and understand that that is really fundamental and will actually alter the baggage you come with and alter the way you see things. And I think there's a lot of hope in that in a way, because I think you're actually starting to recognise that people have all of this, I don't know how you say it, but that, you know, if I'm a recent immigrant from Syria, the way I see things is going to be really different to the way, you know, Super Nan from Maui sees it, you know, and that's good and okay and important to recognise. And if we don't recognise that, we do a disservice to one or the other very fundamentally through language, through systems, through capacity to listen, really. But that listening thing's really interesting. Sorry to be political, but I do wonder at what point we're going to actually deal with Nauru and start listening to the stories that are coming out of there.
Oh, but how would we know about it? No one's allowed to report on it. Well,
this is the thing. I mean, the only things I've heard have come out of, I don't know, what do you call them? Claimant? Asylum seeker claimants in Nauru who have the capacity to write in English, who are writing for the Saturday paper on a regular basis. They're the only stories I've heard coming out of there, apart from Sarah Hanson-Young's visit and what she revealed. But whatever's leaking out, everything is violent and awful. Nothing that we're hearing is positive.
Oh, how could it be?
Yeah.
For those who don't know, Australia has this despicable policy at the moment where anyone who tries to get into our country, we ship off to somewhere very unpleasant, essentially put them in jail for an indefinite period of time. They have no real... there's rights. Pregnant women, there's children, they have no rights, they have no rights to appeal, and they are no longer really a citizen of anywhere. They can't leave and go back to their home, a lot of the time because their home doesn't exist anymore, but also because they're just not allowed to leave, they're in prison. The complicating factor is that we're not allowed to report about it at all. It's actually against Australian law now to report about it in any media, so there's sort of a bit of a lockout, and despite everybody's kind of shame about it, there's also this thing that it's not really talked about anymore. It's been, it's been.
And what you don't see and you don't hear about, I think, well, I get the sense that the majority, there's a pretty big apathy as a result. They're counting on that kind of apathy. They're counting on what you don't know doesn't hurt you, kind of as a philosophy politically, which is a bit disturbing.
They talk about things like 90% of Australia's refugees don't come on boats. They come on planes. Like, we end up just, and the people who apply through these imaginary lines and queues that they talk about, these proper structures that they're meant to, that they're meant to go through, those people aren't necessarily the people in the most need. They're the people with
communities here. It's not actually connected to the, you know, the whole
humanitarian side.
Well, exactly. It's not. I mean, we are actually signatories to the UN and to the agreement about taking people who apply for asylum, and we're shunning our international obligations pretty majorly. I'm sure there's loopholes, and that's why they're in Nauru. But I just, and I'm not sure that then releasing those people into the Nauruan community, it doesn't sound like that's working either, because the people of Nauru aren't necessarily accepting of people. Is that fair enough? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. But it sounds like there's a lot of brutalisation of asylum seekers even when they are released. I mean, not saying that that doesn't happen in Australia either.
Look, it's an interesting topic because you would have travelled around the country a lot. There's not a prevailing feeling of support for opening our borders to all refugees, especially in the country.
But because the rhetoric that's being presented to us on a humanitarian level is that it's counterintuitive. It's saying that if we accept people into our country, that more people will take a risk and get into an unsafe boat and travel over unsafe waters to our shores.
Yeah.
So the argument about putting up, I use the term... the way it's presented to us, better border protection policies, is about protecting people from that journey.
Yes.
But the point is that no one puts themselves in danger unless they're in
Exactly. extraordinary danger. You don't put your child on a rickety boat unless you're desperate.
You don't put your child in danger. No. You don't pour your whole life savings into displacing yourself if you are not absolutely desperate.
Absolutely.
And so that argument doesn't wash with me. The problem is it's perpetuated by a media that is also trying to sell, and so tugging at our heartstrings by presenting the cruelty of the boat. And as you say, the boat is a myth. The boat is part of a story
Peter Reith with the child overboard thing. You know, it was all crap.
Yeah.
But it won them the election.
But if, from a humanitarian perspective, surely there's got to be it's got to be two parts. It's got to be, right, we're going to stop you doing the dangerous one, and we're going to invest in encouraging this other safe method, which is, you know, there's a proper way that you can, and we will look after you, as our commitment to the UN Charter suggests.
It would be cheaper as well in the long run. Like, Nauru is it's expensive to keep people locked up there. I mean, it's billions. Surely the bureaucracy it would take would still be cheaper. The funny thing, even if the economics mattered, which they probably don't.
But you look at America, England, like these places, when they had their economic booms, it was just after a big influx of refugees.
Of course it was.
I mean, it's not like they come here and steal our jobs and whatever.
Oh, all that nonsense, exactly.
It's a it's a very, it just highlights to me how removed the media is from reality. Like, it feels like we're always sold just these funny little convenient lies to manipulate us, but rather than having a proper discussion. But it's also very symptomatic
of that, the real fault line in Australian politics at the moment, which is that everybody is just looking to the next election. It's just about when they can next be elected. It's there's
short-sighted. It's
very short-term,
yeah.
Very limited, very short-term, and very much playing to the lowest common denominator. Yeah.
And, but and that's the problem, because it is so short-term, and it is actually a complex set of factors that are going to need to be put in place to solve this problem and to support those people in a humane way.
And as Rob Oakeshott said in the Saturday paper, a couple of, you know, that he did an editorial, he was saying there are some issues where we must see a bipartisan approach in order to have a more long-term approach, where we actually do need to see both of the parties sit down and agree on the best approach, not to this is probably not something that we need battle lines drawn during the next election on. This is something that we need parties to actually decide to take an approach on and for that to be a humane one.
Well, I mean, we're currently being presented with figures saying that the most humane policy that we have is sending back the boats, because, look, there's no child in detention at the moment because we've sent all the boats back. And I just think that that is absolutely flies in the face of logic.
Yeah.
We are all boat people in this country.
Yeah.
And our capacity... And you talk about the country, and yes, there is, like, you know, sometimes because we are force-fed stuff from the media, but people in the country that I've met, that I know, that I grew up with, are incredibly resilient, open-hearted, generous, hospitable. And I don't believe that the spirit of our country or you know, my communities are, you know, is about this policy that's being sold to us in such a, you know, a motive and persuasive way.
Yeah.
And it is completely counterintuitive.
And totally limiting.
Yeah.
You know, it's so deeply negative, and everything within it is negative, that to find that hope, or to find that thing that's good about, you know, you've got to actually look for the statistics which actually counter these things. And if you're not in a position to look for them, particularly if you're not educated enough to be cynical about the media's messages, I think that's why you end up just saying, oh, well, it can't be good then, because the government's telling me it's not good. And the media's telling me it's not good. And so that's my way, that's my compass to understand this issue, you know?
Here's an interesting one. It was a bit of a doomsday thing that popped into my head while I was having my cold shower this morning.
Right.
Why cold?
Look up Wim Hof. Oh. Wim Hof. He's got 20 world records in all different things. They call him the Iceman. But fascinating. The guy climbed Everest in his shorts. He did a marathon in an African desert. 50 kilometres without hydrating. He believes, although he's being tested too, he's super chi with breathing exercise and stuff. Anyway, I'm trying to get into his breathing and
Just cold, sidebar, we work with a kid who has anaphylactic responses to cold water.
Wow.
Cold water is pretty intense on your system.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it is. It's very intense.
The intensity is the same as saunas. It creates it. Your body releases norepinephrine, which is it's like the super healing substances that stop inflammation in our bodies. So by extreme saunas.
Holy hell, you have researched this. I thought you were just joking about having a cold shower.
Oh, no.
There is a science behind your pain.
Oh, absolutely.
The Colonel never does anything without a reason.
In controlled discomfort, your body has these amazing abilities to heal itself. But we live such cushy lives that we never awaken it. But there's people studying about, you know, oxygen deprivation, extreme cold, extreme heat, and the immense benefits that it has on your body. Anyway,
Is that why that why it's I was oh now this is very vague. This is like a I was reading somewhere statement, but I was reading somewhere about the popularity of people now going into those like barometric pressure chambers.
Yeah.
In order to reduce the signs of aging, that going in and having all the like pressure turned up, you know, like you've got the bends.
Yeah.
Like you'd go into if you'd been abalone diving or something and had the bends.
It's extremely stimulating. This is now seen as
like a really, yeah, like a really fantastic thing for your, you know, your crow's feet and things. It's meant to be, you're meant to come out looking younger.
And
I think I'd come out and faint, but.
Yeah. But aren't there also elite sports people who are sleeping in, and this is part of the science that you're talking about. Yeah, sports science. Yeah. Fascinating.
So do you feel better for your cold shower?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. Look, that's a big topic. But I encourage you, if you're interested, check out Wim Hof, W-I-M-H-O-F. Mm. He's called the Iceman. There's a great doco on him by Vice. But what I was thinking, and it's not – it was a doomsday scenario that went in my head because I'm very concerned about the environment. I'm very concerned about the fact that I think we've gone too far. If you look at all the science, I think it's already happened. What happens when, say, 80% of the world is uninhabitable for humans? And let's say Australia is the last place that is inhabitable and everyone just rushes here. Like, where does humanity fit in that? Do we end up bonding together, or do we end up bolstering our borders and just trying to kill everyone who comes in?
What was that terrible movie that's about that? You know, and they've made like, it's sort of like a Noah's Ark idea. They've made these sort of big ships to take as many people as they can. Is that what it is?
Oh, I don't know. It's a dreadful film. Oh,
dreadful film. But gee, it's fascinating when they...
Who gets to go on the boat?
Exactly. Well, who gets to go on and, you know, at what point do you say it's me and no one else, and why are you more valid than someone else? And this, because one of the boats is sort of given over for the scientists, and they get these kind of quite luxurious rooms that could fit about six people, and one of them has the, you know, attack of the guilts and sort of lets some people on to live in their room and then regrets it. You know, it's an interesting...
Once you realise the logistics of sharing a toilet with five other people,
that's when you... There's a lot to regret there. Forget humanity. Yeah, exactly. But I do think that that's... I mean, this is the issue with the short-term thing as well. You know, at what point do politicians engage with the reality that we are depleting... The Earth, there isn't another one. I know some people claim Mars will be the next one, but I'm yet to be convinced by that. And I saw The Martian, and I don't know if you guys did, but it didn't make me feel very hopeful about Mars as an environment to live in. I don't really want to grow potatoes in my own shit.
I was going to say, it did restore my faith in Matt Damon's acting.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
That was about all it did for me. Yeah. I know.
It's a funny movie, actually. I didn't think a lot happened. It was like a bunch of cool science-y stuff. But
I was completely booked.
I was pretty into it. Oh, I have to say, I love that line when he said, I'm just going to have to science the shit out of it. I was like,
The start of it was quite rushed. Like he was on Mars and was kind of like, I don't even really like you yet. I don't know that I care that you're on Mars.
I have never
cared so much about potato growing in all my life.
I know, well, this is the thing. Being invested in the. I mean, it was a tribute to botanists, wasn't it?
It does. But this is like, you know, in a roundabout way, coming back to answer the Colonel's question, it does also, like, prove something about our resilience as a species. I mean, I am cushy as all get out. And there are certain, like factors that I have around me that I've just gotten used to. Entering a lift, there is a certain amount of space that I demand around me. You know what I'm saying? There is that comfy chair that I like to have at home, and I won't feel relaxed until it's there. The proof of the fact is, though, that, you know, through my job, I've had the privilege of working in different countries where I know that there are whole families who live in spaces that are smaller than my bathroom. and are incredibly resilient and capable of surviving on much less than I do. And so our sense of what is copable, like, and what is reasonable, I think
it's totally warped.
It's completely warped.
We've got that very first world.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And
we've had a theme today, haven't we, of our sort of like
privilege. Sort of,
our first world privilege and how that makes so much about the baggage and horror of history and the present day difficult to conceive, difficult to really understand.
I love the way that you just tried to summarise that whole conversation.
Well, that's true. Like, we've got so many strings, like, but they're all actually very connected.
Yeah.
You know, to the disappointment of politics, really, the disappointment of what it is.
Anyway. Now, look, we've gone well over time and I don't really want to wrap things up, but... I thought I'd try and finish with something a little bit light.
Oh, good. You always do this well, Colonel.
Because you're a musician and, you know, we all love music. I wanted to ask a couple of questions about music. One is, do you have any songs that are cover songs that you like better than the original version?
Oh, good question.
I'll start some off because this is something I think about a lot. And you might disagree with me here. Yep. Whitney Houston singing "I Will Always Love You," despite it's a Dolly Parton song.
Look behind you, Colonel. There is the line.
I thought that'd be a bit touchy.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that.
One of the best vocal performances ever.
I love that song.
But you know, it is Dolly, so
it's a Dolly song. It's definitely Dolly's song, and her version is so fragile and so beautiful. I don't know.
You don't think the cover cuts it?
I don't know that the Bodyguard version really cuts it.
Okay.
God, I love that film when he eats the peach off the knife because he's just so cool.
What about a cover
song? There is a Tori Amos version of Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Oh, cool.
Which is a killer because that song was so caught up for me with, you know, teenage angst and pain.
And deeply masculine
in my head. Absolutely. Yeah. And Tori Amos for me was this incredible voice in the wilderness in the 90s for me, in this sort of what I deemed to be like quite a musical wasteland. There was not a lot that I sort of felt like I was really... you know, completely connecting to, and Tori sort of cut through all the bullshit and just told some really very dark bloody stories, and then sort of moved into the second album and started talking about a whole bunch of like very strange things involving cornflakes and stuff, but that she does that cover of Smells Like Teen Spirit, and it takes on new meaning. She owns it. And it was the first time I actually ever heard the lyrics properly. And I think that's the thing where there's also another cover by Johnny Cash of the U2 song One that takes all of the rock stadium bullshit out of that song and makes it's a country song. Yeah. And it's bloody, he does a bloody magnificent version of it. Those are my two. There you go.
Nick Cave wrote a song called The Mercy Seat.
Oh, yeah.
You know the one?
Johnny Cash does a version of that too.
Well, he wrote it for Johnny Cash.
Wow.
He recorded his own version because he wrote it, but he always had Johnny Cash in mind. And when Johnny Cash finally did it, I mean, it's a song about a guy in the electric chair. And going through this process before he dies. And when Johnny Cash sings that, it's just amazing. Really, really cool.
I'll give you my twee answer.
Great.
So I've just bought recently, because I'm, you know, slow on the music front, the Triple J Like a Virgin 2 album. And it's got a really, I don't even know who does it. Can't tell you who does this cover. But there's a cover of End of the Road. Now we've come to the end of the road. And again, it's because it's sung with a female voice. And it just R&Bs it. To such an extent that you hear it in this whole different way. You hear the vulnerability in it and it's quite moving in a different way. It's the same sort of thing, I guess.
It's strange because that is a very sweet song, the Boys to Men
version. It is Boys to Men, isn't it?
But if you listen to it, girl...
Oh, yeah, that spoken bit.
You really, girl, you know you really love me. you just don't realize.
Oh, it's a bit stalkery, isn't it?
It's creepy. It's like she's left him, and
It's like the lyrics to. Have you ever listened to the lyrics of "Boys of Summer," Don Henley song?
No.
Do you remember those nights? I wonder if it was a dream. Remember how you made me crazy? Remember how I made you scream? It's a deeply disturbing song.
Oh, I've never thought of it on that level.
I'm driving by your house. I know that you're not home. Oh. He's stalking her.
Creepy.
It's real. Yeah. It's real
like
creepy.
Same as that. I've got you under my skin.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah.
I got some others. All right, did you know Wendy Matthews, The Day You Went Away, is a cover?
That's a good one. I love that song.
Mm. I don't think anyone knows it's a cover either.
Who did the original?
It was Soul Family Sensation, and it's like an electro disco.
bizarre
song. She just rocked that song. Mm. It was amazing.
I love the Baseball's version of Umbrella as well.
That's cool. Because it
sort of sounds like a 60s.
You played that for me once, and I was like, oh, wow, this is cool.
It's really cool. It sort of makes it sound like a 60s, like
sort of a Beach Elvis, Boys version,
Elvis
isn't it?
Presley sort of version of the song. And the first time my son heard it, he went, wow, I didn't know that Rihanna had done a cover of that song. It sort of sounds like they put it into
the original.
It's the original. They put it into a different era. There you go.
Mm.
Mad World. Gary Jules for Donnie Darko.
Yeah, yeah.
Tears for Fears. And the Tears for Fears version, once you've heard it in all its delicate loneliness, like isolation, that Gary Jules did it for that movie, then you go back to this sort of up-tempo thing. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work as a song.
Yeah, but there is something about that version too. Like that whole genre of music, that new romantic genre in the 80s, there was something a bit fringe dwellery about that style of music too.
Mm.
It sort of moved into like being played in like really bad nightclubs at 2 o'clock in the morning as being like pop music.
Mm.
But there's something about it too, which was reaching out to disenfranchised young people. And like, I remember listening to that song, that Tears for Fears version in the 80s and went, oh, it just spoke to the core of my like self-obsessed teenage angst. Just did.
It was your favourite adolescent navel-gazing song.
Oh, yeah.
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 One more. Cat in the Cradle. It's a Cat Stevens song. Mm. But it was covered by Ugly Kid Joe in about 1993. And I get more emotion out of the Ugly Kid Joe, like when those angry guitars come in and it's...
Mm.
My boy was just like me. You know, it gets a bit angry about it. And it
do you think it was that the context, or was it that the first time that you'd heard that song, was that version?
I'd heard it before.
Yeah.
Look, I really can't tell
you. It's not Cat Stevens, by the way. I don't know who it is, but it's not Cat Stevens. Really? I'm just going to, all right, ask
fact
Google.
Check, fact check.
Fact check, but it is definitely not Cat Stevens.
Wow.
But I think I think I probably did hear the Ugly Kid Joe version first in my life.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to me because the Ugly Kid Joe version is still the version that many of the young people we teach go, oh, isn't that cool the way it comes around? They love the circular narrative of that.
Yeah.
They love the reflection of it. They see that
but
as
it's
sort
a
of...
bloody beautifully crafted song.
Yeah, and it is a true message, I guess, you know.
Harry Chapin.
There we go.
Harry Chapin. You're right. My mum was asking me to learn some Cat Stevens songs.
Oh, right.
And she said, Cat's in the Cradle. And I remember saying to her, that's not actually Cat Stevens.
Yeah.
Did he do it too? Or
is no, that what no, we've got it's just no. around the same time.
Oh, okay, right.
But, you know,
same
he
period.
Wrote Father and Son. So there's that song that sort of sits in that genre of like, you know.
It's like California Dreaming. Everyone thinks it's the Beach Boys. It's the Mamas and Papas, but it sounded like the Beach Boys.
Yeah.
Weird. Yeah. The Mamas and Papas. There was like a weird thing going on with sexual abuse between, you know, like one of the Papas and one of the kids. Really creepy.
Oh, so creepy. Well, I think if you call your band Mamas and Papas, it's creepy.
It's pretty creepy as it is.
So much creepiness in the world, Colonel.
So much. But not here. No. Not here at Peachy and the Colonel. No. We're going to wrap things up. it's been such a delight to have a chat to you about all sorts of weird and wonderful things, Michael. Yeah,
thank you.
What can people do to find out more about your music?
There's a website,
yep.
michaelwaugh.com.au.
It's war as in W-A-U-G-H.
That's right.
Not the
like the cricketer, which will mean nothing to anyone.
Means a lot to me.
It does. Right. It does. I get Mark War a lot because people are so Mike, associate the, Mark. But it's Michael. Yeah,
Michael.
Michael War, and it's on all of those. You can YouTube me. There's a couple of YouTube clips, and
we'll chuck some links up on our site and make sure people can find you because I've loved listening to your music.
Thank you.
Particularly the Mafra Under 10s. That was very, it brought back some nice imagery for me.
Good.
Yeah.
Going to wrap things up. Peachy, it's been a delight to talk to you again, even after all these years. We still find things to talk about.
Still things to talk about.
It's and amazing. There'll be more to talk about next time. So thanks for not tuning in.
I caught myself. Every time, yes.
Thanks for logging on. Thanks for downloading us and having a chat. We love this format. It's one of the last forms of media in the world that's not controlled by companies and advertising, and we can say whatever the fuck we want.
Mm.
Excuse my language, but I don't have to excuse my language. I can do what I want. Thanks for tuning in. Damn it, I've done it again.
Facebook.
Thanks for downloading us. Jump on our Facebook, get in touch, and make sure you check out Michael War's fantastic music. Anyway, take care. Love you all, and we'll be in touch soon. Bye-bye.